This podcast is designed to help you understand the laws of our land. I am your host, Hattie Savari, and here to help you every step of the way, whether you are a tenant, landlord, parent, child, employee, employer, neighbour or business owner, and we are all most certainly consumers. The law is in your life every single day with over 180 episodes and 5 million downloads. Get ready to listen and empower yourself with tons of jargon-free legal information in plain and simple English. Today's episode is supported by Red Bar Law, the go-to law firm for expert, efficient and fast legal assistance, all at a fixed cost. Go to our website at redbarlaw.com. Empower yourself today with legal knowledge and follow us on Instagram, Twitter or Facebook to get access to jargon-free legal information in plain and simple English. Today's episode is supported by Red Bar Law, the go-to law firm for expert, efficient and fast legal assistance, all at a fixed cost. Go to our website at redbarlaw.com. Our episodes are free to access. However, if you feel that you would like to support the children's charity that we are raising money for, then head over to our Just Giving page at justgiving.com and search for Hattie Savari, where we are raising money for orphaned children at SOS Children's Villages, one of the worthiest children's charities. Donate as little as £1 for a great cause. Thank you. Hello and welcome to our podcast at Get Legally Speaking. Our legal conversation today will be on what is a barrister, what do they do, and demystifying the bar. This is part two of our What is a Barrister podcast, so please do listen to our part one. I am joined today by barrister Joanna Hardy from Red Lion Chambers in London. Joanna is an approachable, experienced and diligent barrister who is praised by the Legal 500 as having a sure touch with clients and the court alike. She's regularly instructed to advise and act in cases involving difficult points of law, and she is instructed by both the defence and the prosecution. Thank you very much for joining us, Joanna.
It's lovely to be here, Hattie. Lovely to see and hear you again.
Yes, thank you. So in our part one, I just quickly want to remind our listeners, Joanna, what we discussed in part one of this podcast. So we said, we discussed what do barristers do? What's the difference between a barrister and a solicitor? Why are barristers sometimes referred as counsel? The terms used to refer as barristers. Why do some barristers wear wigs and black cloaks in court? How many barristers are working in the UK? Do I have to have a legal matter in court to take advice from a barrister? Or could I instruct a barrister to give me advice very early on before any legal proceedings are issued? What are chambers? Why do barristers belong to sets of chambers? What does a barrister's clerk do? And what is the difference between a QC barrister and a junior barrister? And what is the governing body for barristers? So that's the questions that we had a chat about in part one. We're going to start our part two with the first question, which is, why don't barristers shake hands, Joanna?
Now, Hattie, we get asked this all the time. Whenever I have mini pupils with me, so people on work experience, they're always quite obsessed with this. Like, why don't you shake hands with people at work? Because it's such a natural thing to do. And yes. I always thought, and I'm half right, I always thought it was because you don't want to really be seen by your client to be too pally with the other side. Mm-hmm. And that's where I always thought it came from. But in fact, I've learned, and I've looked into this, that there's a much more exciting reason, which is that back in the day,
swords.
When people took their swords around, I don't have a sword, and none of your listeners should be carrying a sword around. Shaking hands was to show that you were no threat, because if your right hand was extended, it was not on the hilt of your sword. You couldn't draw it.
Yes.
But it was a gesture of being conciliatory. And so that's where it comes from. It survived in the bar for reasons that I think are my reasons, which are that it isn't a great look to be too pally with an opponent in any litigation, because we have an adversarial system. But yes. it's a raging debate, because some people take the view that it's rude, it's just natural to be professional and to shake hands, and so they go around shaking hands with everybody. And every now and then you get an old school person that doesn't shake hands coming up against
Have you ever extended your hand and had it floating, or have you just not never gone.
I've seen that happen. I've seen somebody be completely mortified, you know, just extend their hand to somebody and just, they just look at it as if they've extended. You know,
I have to say, that happens to me, but not with a barrister. It happened to me in a different business setting with a cultural setting of the persons that I was meeting is that they do not shake hands with women. Men and women don't shake hands. So that happened to me in that kind of setting. My hand was just left in the air. One of the worst things that can happen to you just as you approach a business meeting, and obviously with people that I hadn't met in business before, so it really wasn't a good look. But no, it is a very interesting historical reason, and I agree with you. I think that if you walked up to the opposition, or the opposition came over to you and your client is sitting there and they gave you their hand and you had a nice good old shake of a hand, it shows perhaps some sort of pallying up, where your client might think, oh, we're all cozied up, are we?
We've got to be a bit careful, because at the bar, lots of us are really good friends. And so the last thing you ever want is, you know, you're really tearing strips off each other in court, and no one would ever hold back because they're against a friend or a colleague in chambers, for example. But it does.
I'm glad you've clarified that point there.
Yeah, but you do know people, you know, you have people who've been each other's best men against each other. It's just something that we all learn to deal with. You know, when you're in court, you're
part of the culture, isn't it? Doesn't matter who. And I think that's important to say, because if your barrister says, look, I know the barrister really well on the other side, I don't think it's anything normally to worry about, because the barrister's duty is to you as your client rather than to them. But it is hard to imagine that. Probably a bit like wrestlers, Joanna. You know, wrestlers sit there and go into the ring. And literally, as we all know, especially in America, you know, they have some great wrestling matches, and they come out and they give each other the hug and the handshake. And I think they're just poking his eyes out, especially in that cage fighting stuff.
That's the first and only time I've been compared to a wrestler, and I really like it. I'm going to keep that happy.
It's the cage fighting. I remember years ago, I watched it once, and then literally they came. I just thought, these people are going to just kill each other alive. And they came out and they're all smiles and hugging. And I thought, wow. But no, in terms of why don't barristers shake hands, I think it's really interesting to know the historical reason, and also the modern, perhaps, reason that most barristers won't sit there and put the hand out to another barrister, at least. Okay, so what are the benefits of having a barrister represent me in a court hearing? And I have some very, very, I don't like to say strong views, but I think that in a court, you know, a barrister should represent a client. You wouldn't go and try to service your car if you weren't a car mechanic, or plumb your boiler if you weren't a plumber, or lay your bricks for your house if you're not a builder. So why would you go into court under such circumstances where you need the best representation and try to do it yourself? What do you think about that question, Joanna?
Yeah, I mean, it's a hard job, and it's a really skilled job, and it takes a very long time to master and a very long time to become good at it. And it's not just about knowing the law. It's about knowing the procedure, knowing the courtroom, knowing the etiquette, knowing the best strategy to get your client the best result possible. And by definition, somebody on their own, acting on their own, is probably, not always, some people act on their own and they win, but probably not going to be as good at that as an experienced professional. And as you say, it's not really for amateurs. You walk into a courtroom and it's like a different world. And we can have a debate about whether that's right or it's wrong, but it's a fact. The advocacy extends much further than standing up and putting forward what your client says happened. You know, it's written advocacy, it's verbal advocacy on the legal provisions. It's mastering the nooks and the crannies, and often that's where cases are won or they're lost. So it does require a real specialist, and barristers, and now some solicitors who have higher rights, are highly trained advocates, and they are trained and specialists in courtroom and out of courtroom advocacy.
Yes, no, I mean, I couldn't agree more, because, you know, the fact is that I think it's very helpful and useful for people to know, you know, some of the law surrounding their case. I mean, Get Legally Speaking is about, you know, it's teaching people and discussing and making things simple for people to understand. But there comes a place where if you're in a court hearing, and the skills involved in delivering the your side of the story. And we've discussed this actually in other podcasts in with other topics and said, you know, should I go along? If I go along to represent myself, we've got a podcast called Representing Myself in Court, actually. And you know, for people who actually financially just cannot, you know, bear the costs of it, because it can be costly, but there is a massive benefit of having a professional represent you, particularly if the other side is represented and then you're up against another barrister. That's, I've seen that a lot in my law firm, whenever we've had somebody acting in person in on the other side, the judge will be listening to the professional, to the barrister that is there to assist the court, and you can get lost very, very quickly in that situation, as you know,
Hattie, I speak from the position of a criminal barrister. So
yes,
everyone with a low income in my sphere of law will be provided, as long as the case is falls into relevant categories, which are still large categories, they will be provided with a barrister at the cost of the state. But yes, I hear what you say, because in some jurisdictions there isn't legal aid available, and people who don't have means are on their own.
Yes.
And it is incredibly difficult. The only thing I would hope is that those people are treated, and I've heard anecdotally that they are treated very well by the judges and by the court staff, and they're helped along. Yeah, which is heartening, but it's no replacement for what should be happening, which is if somebody's involved in serious litigation, no matter what the sphere, they should have the opportunity to have representation.
No, indeed. And you're absolutely right. I have heard, I have seen, you know, and been in a courtroom where the judges have been so helpful, bending over backwards to help people. And that's great to see. But that's not a court's first duty, if you know what I mean. I mean, they will do it because, you know, if somebody's a litigant in person, to try and get them to understand. So there's great benefits of having a barrister represent you in court, particularly if you have a very complicated legal matter. It's not so straightforward. It's not just a sort of housekeeping hearing, as we say. But yes, okay. So here we go. Next question, which I think is a very interesting question, Joanna, is, can I choose who my barrister will be, even if my solicitor decides to select a barrister for my case?
So traditionally speaking, if a lay client is instructing a solicitor, it's the solicitor who instructs the barrister. That's the chain of instruction. But speaking practically and pragmatically in my work, I know that the solicitors will instruct the barrister that they feel is both best suited to the case, has the relevant specialisms and experience, but also the barrister who's going to be the best fit for that case. It might be for example, I do a lot of work with vulnerable defendants. I represent at the moment a child who's aged 13 with difficulties. And I hope the reason why my solicitor has instructed me is not just because I'm experienced in that particular area of law, but because I'm experienced in handling vulnerable people in the criminal justice system.
Yes.
So it's a real global, quite organic process, choosing a barrister. And if a solicitor chooses a barrister and the lay client says, well, I'm not having that barrister, I don't get on with them, it's not going to work, I'm not going to give you my instructions, the process breaks down, because it is teamwork if that's the model that's being used. So it's like anything in this job, it's about really getting the right fit, and ensuring that whoever they're instructing has the relevant skill set and professional skills to really undertake the case at hand. And increasingly now I have clients who come to me with the solicitor for the first ever time into my chambers to meet me, and so often they've printed off my website, and they know more about me than I'm used to perhaps 5 years ago, when the kind of online shopping world didn't really exist. But now they turn up and they say, I've seen your Twitter feed, I've seen your website, I've seen this authority that you've been in, I've downloaded it off Bailey. And you think, you know, this is
that's the thing, isn't it?
Yeah, so it can be quite an informed marketplace. And I imagine that outside of crime, that only increases, because those engaged in criminal litigation are often not always in positions of vulnerability. They might be in custody, and you know, they're obviously not at liberty
with the freedom to be able to go and have a look. But I think to add to that, that I think what is important is for you to get to know your barrister before any court hearings, and as they are instructed to do your work. Obviously, a solicitor, for example, may delegate some core work to a barrister before you get to meet your barrister. But, you know, one of the things that we certainly do in my law firm is we have a conference with the barrister and the client very, very early on, because we believe that barrister-client relationship is very important, even if the matter is not contentious. Because if the client relationship with the barrister is good and you do end up going the miles and you're in court, then it's so important for the barrister to understand the client. Not just in a way where they've turned up to court and the solicitor says, right, here's your barrister, they'll be going in and fighting your corner for you. I think it's important that barristers have the opportunity to meet their clients and ask their own questions to the clients and engage to make, you know, their work, work better for the client.
I agree. And sometimes it's our job to give tough advice that perhaps isn't what people want to hear.
Yes, I know that place. Managing expectations, is that the term that we like to use as well?
It's so much easier to give somebody robust advice if you've met them and they think, well, actually, we've met Joanna, she's a decent barrister, she's on top of our brief, she's taken the time to meet us. Yeah, and she's able to actually turn around and say, do you know what, I think you should consider your position on X, because you're going to lose that point, in my professional opinion. And if that's advice that I need to give that perhaps is not going to be particularly welcome, it's a lot easier to give it if you've
met a relationship
before. We struggle in the criminal courts because the courts sometimes, not always, but sometimes are less willing to list cases for counsel's convenience, which means that we have to return cases sometimes at the last minute. And it means that people are at court with a brand new face, brand new advice, brand new way of working. It's not fair. So we at the criminal bar, I think the civil courts are a lot better at listing things. But at the criminal bar, we start warn lists where things could come in on a Monday, on a Tuesday, on a Wednesday. You know, I call it surprise listings. You get to 4 o'clock and the court is like, surprise, you're doing an entire trial tomorrow. And it's just, it's not on,
it's
really.
It's a lot of hard work as well. No,
yeah, it goes to the core of what you're saying, Hattie.
I totally get it. And, you know, I've always said that, you know, barristers work very, very, very hard. And when listings do come the night before, of course, in those situations, it's almost impossible for you to have had a conference beforehand in detail and things like that. But where possible, if you do get, you know, you can request to say, look, I'd like to meet my barrister prior to going into the courtroom, or prior to the court date, or prior to them doing a key bit of work. Yes, if you're privately paying, you know, there'll be a fee for that. But I think that strengthens the team and strengthens the understanding between the client and the barrister. Okay, so next question, Joanna, is what does it mean when barristers provide opinions of points of law? And I've had this question quite often when I've said, look, we need to go back to our barrister, because I would always allocate a barrister to any matter from the beginning, contentious or not contentious. I think it's a healthy thing to do in order to get your strategy right, in order for the barrister to have the input from the beginning, so that you know where you're going with it, and in a legally in a strong position, a stronger position as you can be. And people have said, well, what do you mean on that, getting a barrister's opinion on that bit, you know, on that point of law? Well, let's break that down a little bit, make it easier for people to understand.
Yeah, so there's no point, or there's not much point, in being a good barrister if the only people who understand what you're talking about are other barristers. I mean, that's not the service we provide. We don't just talk to each other. One, because that would be incredibly boring. But two, because our actual clientele, the object of our advice, are often lay people. And so the real skill is to know the law, know the procedure, know the complexities, but being able to distill it, being able to explain it for people who aren't lawyers. And it's like a carpenter. If a carpenter came to fit up your kitchen, he'd tell you the breakfast island is going to end at your conservatory. Yes. It's going to be in the grey colour that you want. He wouldn't be saying to you, this is the code I'm going to use at the bulk buying place. This is the technical name for the joining. This is the precise angle of the worktop counter. He'd tell you what you understand and what you are going to visualize and see. And that's because we hire professionals to get a job done, not to go through all of the innards, all the ugly parts of it in minute detail. So whenever I write an opinion or an advice, what I'm doing is I'm taking the law, but I'm distilling it for someone to understand how it applies to their facts, how it applies to their case, their prospects, and their options. And that's a good advice. That would be something that is document that's user friendly.
Well, that's exactly what we're doing with Get Legally Speaking. We're taking every area of law that we can as a subject matter, and we're putting it in layman's terms. We're saying to people, yeah, here it is in as plain as English as we can get. And that's that, you know, that's good. That's what people, yeah, want to hear.
Distilling it down. And sometimes an opinion might be for, you know, not for a lay client. You might write an opinion for a solicitor, you might write it for funding for something, or for an expert, for example. So written documents from counsel can be for a variety of audiences, but you've got to tailor it. And if you're writing a document that's for a lay client, it really needs to put the law in digestible language, apply it to the situation that they're sitting in. They're not interested in an academic, you know, chapter on what they're doing.
Exactly.
And I always tend to put in quite practical things as well. You know, if I'm doing a case that I think will attract publicity, if I think my client is going to end up in the local newspaper, because in my experience, yes, this is an unusual type of crime, I think the papers will be interested, I give them some advice on that and on pragmatic arrangements. So just slightly outside pure law, I try and think, you know, if that was my mum, my dad, my brother, my friend sitting there, what would they want to know? And that's what I try to provide whenever I write an advice.
Good. No, good stuff. Okay. I'm going to try and get our last three questions in. Okay. So the next one is, can I instruct a barrister directly myself without hiring a solicitor? So we're talking about, we want to touch on direct access. So that's whether lots of people know or whether they don't know, it's a very interesting way of instructing and getting legal assistance, where you go as a layperson directly to a barrister and say, I'm not hiring a solicitor. Can people do that? Yes, they can,
yes.
I guess.
Yeah, okay. They can.
And what would you say are the benefits of doing that at direct access?
To put it swiftly, the benefits will vary depending on the case. And my key line for direct access work is that not all cases are suitable for it.
No, indeed.
In my experience, and I speak as a criminal barrister that undertakes quite high level, quite complicated work, I don't accept direct access cases, even though I'm direct access qualified, because I take the view that the type of work I do requires additional and specialist work from my very good, very hardworking,
for
excellent
preparation,
solicitor.
Yeah, to be prepared and presented to you by a solicitor's firm.
Yes, and more than that, you know, there's an awful lot of other tasks and roles that they can perform that I can't. But some cases are suitable for a member of the public to approach a direct access qualified barrister. We have to have been on a call. And it's usually cases that are more straightforward or that don't involve an incredible amount of complexity or litigation, because the litigation work needs to be carried out otherwise by somebody qualified to do it. So it's a very careful balance. It's a good development when it works, but everybody needs to be careful, is my bottom line, Hattie. And anyone that's interested in instructing a direct access barrister can find the directory on the Bar Standards Board or the Bar Council website, one of those. And there's a whole directory of those of us that are qualified.
There is. I mean, if you put direct access barrister, if you Google that term, so much comes up in terms of companies that assist you in finding direct access barrister or chambers that do direct access work. I mean, one thing I would say is that if you're thinking of instructing a direct access barrister, one of the benefits is known to be the cost can reduce, let's say that, because if you've got a barrister doing every bit of your work, then they have to charge accordingly. But the cost can be less if a solicitor's not involved and you yourself are capable of doing a lot of the groundwork to prepare and have things in an efficient manner delivered to the barrister. If they're obviously prepared to take your case on a direct access basis, it is not a hand-holding exercise, so you do not get the hand-holding I would say as much as you do when you go to a solicitor's firm and instruct a solicitor's firm to do your work for you that then goes and instructs a barrister. But it is an interesting development. It's not for everybody, in terms of it's not for every client and it's not for every barrister. Like yourself, even in litigation, I've had barristers call me up and say that this client came to me as direct access. I've told them they have to instruct a solicitor because there's so much work that the barrister really should not be spending their time doing. A solicitor's firm should do that for them so that the barrister can then focus on the legal and the core elements of the case. Okay, so now for a little bit, ending it our conversation with a little bit of lightheartedness. Who and when was the first female practicing barrister? And I was actually quite surprised when I heard it was 1922.
Yeah, so Helena Normanton was the first woman to practice as a barrister in England, but she was the second to be called to the bar. So a lady called Ivy Williams was called in 1922. So yeah, Helena Normanton. And interestingly, she when she got married, she didn't take her husband's surname. And that's something that we see a lot
like
at the bar. Yeah, and we see a lot in quite a few professions, actually, where women often have made their name as single women.
Barristers don't, and they stay as Miss. Female barristers stay as a Miss. They don't become a Mrs. when they get married.
Yeah, some have. I know some that do, but very few. Most people remain Miss and they keep their surname. Some people start double barreling and we end up with all sorts of different combinations. And it's all lovely. It's all personal choice. But I just found it quite interesting that she was the first woman to practice, but she was also the first woman to keep her surname, not just at the bar, but on her passport. She was the first one to do that. So, yeah, we have a lot to thank Helena for.
Yes, no, indeed. Okay, and how diverse is the bar? How many women versus men are they practicing at the bar as barristers, Joanna? Do we know those figures?
We do. You'd hope that I'd just give you one answer, Hattie, but you know me. No, get ready. This is my pet topic as well. So when women enter the bar, women and men, it's about 50-50. There's actually marginally more women entering the bar. So brilliant work.
Interesting.
Well done, everybody. But we look at our QC level, our top level, and it's only 16% women. Now, that will be something
16.
To do with the fact that, 1-6.
Whoa, okay.
That will be something to do with the fact that many years ago, the entry wasn't 50-50. So that funneling through effect hasn't quite reached there. But it's actually a bit more than that, because what we've learnt, and the Western Circuit have done a lot of work on this, is that there's a drop-off point. We have a retention problem with women at the bar. We can all guess at what point that is. It's when women are generally the age at women to start
family.
So the overall percentage as of 2019 was about 38%. So there's a lot of work to do, but the entry level statistics are promising, but we've got work to do on retention. Similarly, I'll link, when you tweet out this podcast, I'll link in the most recent diversity report of the bar, because I could talk to you all day about social mobility at the bar, our disabled figures, those that answered that question and made a disclosure as to whether or not they considered themselves to have a disability was lower than the average we see in the working population. So there's a concern there. Our BAME figures are still lower than the average working age population, but they increase more in this cycle than they have done ever previously, and they're a lot closer than some of the other topics that have been looked at. So there's promise there, but still the silk levels of our BAME candidates are low, so work to be done on all factors. Our independent schooling figures are appalling. It's a very heavily weighted. Of those that responded, that was low. It's very heavily weighted in terms of independent education. So we do a huge amount of work at the bar, but we've got a long way to go.
I instruct. I have instructed a lot of female barristers who have a heavy home life as well because of having young children and things like that. I actually think for those people that are considering even going into the profession, you know, women who think, gosh, will I have to stop my career if I have children? I would say, no, you don't have to stop your career, actually, because you are self-employed as a barrister and you belong to a set of chambers. And it's up to you to say, okay, this is the level of work I want to do, and I will work from home maybe 4 days a week or 3 days a week. You do have a massive amount of flexibility. It's a career with prestige, I think, that gives you huge amounts of flexibility. It's not like you have to turn up to the client's office, to your working office every day to be able to conduct your work. Lots of barristers, actually, even very busy practicing barristers, do work from home quite a lot. And also, you know, yes, there'll be court appearances if you choose to do those. But I think the bar, actually, in the way that you work, can provide a good level of flexibility. If you said, right, I'm having a family, I don't want to go for childcare, I don't have those childcare options, and I'll just scale down my work, but I'll keep practicing. You know, and I've instructed barristers who've got newborn babies at home, and they're still working, they're still doing some level of work. So I would say that
I think it depends on the practice area as well. I mean, we struggle in crime because obviously we go to court every single day, and so if you don't have childcare, I know it's very difficult. But for some barristers who have a more flexible practice in the way that you exactly describe, so work they can do from home, you know, paper-based practices, advices, teleconferences in the way that we're speaking today. I imagine that it being self-employed and having that flexibility and having clerks who understand and are, you know, incredibly flexible themselves in the allocation of work, it can be done. And women have proven time and time again, it can be done. But the differences between practice areas are acute, and criminal barristers in particular struggle, but we're well supported by good clerks and we're all working hard.
It's all about the clerks. I just got a book about the about being a barrister's clerk. The first written, I think, by a clerk, which is really interesting to read. Yeah. But Joanna, thank you ever so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Another great podcast. Really pleased to have recorded this. So I'll say to our listeners, don't forget to click and subscribe on our podcasts. And you can find us on Twitter, Facebook and LinkedIn by searching Get Legally Speaking. Also visit our website at getlegallyspeaking.com. Thank you for listening. Empower yourself today with legal knowledge and follow us on Instagram, Twitter or Facebook to get access to jargon-free legal information in plain and simple English. Today's episode is supported by Red Bar Law, the go-to law firm for expert, efficient and fast legal assistance, all at a fixed cost. Go to our website at redbarlaw.com. Our episodes are free to access. However, if you feel that you would like to support the children's charity that we are raising money for, then head over to our Just Giving page at justgiving.com and search for Hattie Savari, where we are raising money for orphaned children at SOS Children's Villages, one of the worthiest children's charities. Donate as little as £1 for a great cause. Thank you.